I want to take up two explicit problems. It's going to sound a bit portentous in the sense of these, are, I think, are the major problems that we should really be thinking about at this time. And the two problems are, first of all, the issue of the paths of technological and scientific change. In old-fashioned Marxist language, revolutions in productive forces. And the second issue is the issue which goes under the name of globalization right now, which is the reorganization of the world economy along rather new lines. In both cases, I want to argue that these processes are driven by capital accumulation and that they've been with us for a very, very long time. The paths of technological change have been connected to the military-industrial complex since the 16th century, at least, if not before. Globalization has been going on, the formation of the world market through trade, export of capital, transformation of labor forces in different parts of the world. That's been going on since at least 1492, if not before. So both of the processes I'm talking about are long-standing, but I think a case, strong case can be made that over the last 20 or 30 years, they're ratcheted into a slightly different terrain, which makes them qualitatively rather different. I'm not going to spend much time on the technological scientific side, except to say the following. Of course, there's a lot made of the creation of cyberspace, the internet, computer technology, information revolutions, and all the rest of it, and that is clearly a very important component part of the new kind of world in which we're living, which poses a whole set of specific issues, and of course it does connect very strongly to the globalization process. But I think even more important, as far as I'm concerned, the revolutions which have been occurring in biological understandings and biological technologies over the last 20 or 30 years. I think processes of genetic engineering, genetic interventions, genetic transformations are rather critical because they're making open or opening up the possibility that we can actually intervene at that level in the evolutionary process and intervene in major ways. Now, of course, human beings have always been evolutionary agents through plant breeding, habitat modification, and the like, but this seems to me to be somewhat qualitatively different in that we're intervening at a level and with a set of mechanics which are instantaneous as opposed to rather long drawn out. And these revolutions pose immediately the question of what kind of evolutionary process we wish to be engaged with. That through both the indirect interventions of habitat destruction, habitat modification, and through genetic interventions, we are in a position to control the evolutionary process or intervene in it in these fundamental ways, not only in terms of our evolution, but also the evolution of many of the species on the Earth. This then poses a whole set of issues as to whether this evolutionary process should be left to the direction of the multinationals, should be left, as it were, in the hands of to construct. What kind of planet do we want to live on? What kind of species diversity do we wish to maintain? So all of these issues, it seems to me, collect around the notion that we are at this point of either a conscious discussion of these questions and an attempt, not necessarily to come to a specific answer, but at least to transform and intervene in the processes that are transforming and intervening in the evolutionary process, that whether we're going to do that or just sort of be objects of this evolutionary process and just, as it were, let it happen. And it seems to me there's a very important topic of conversation to be had around that question. The second issue is the globalization process, again, been going on for a very, very long time. But over the last 30 or so years, it's been connected, of course, with this strong financialization of capital, the organization of financial markets, the reorganization of divisions of labor on a world scale, the deindustrialization and reindustrialization, all of those sorts of things which you may well be familiar with. Now, we can make an analysis of globalization. I don't propose to do that here. And there are various ways in which it can be understood. But I want to point out a number of specific elements about it, because I also want to see it as a somewhat contradictory process and a rather more complicated process than is usually sort of set out in the literature. Now, the first point I want to make about it is that an interesting dialogue has been set up, as it were, between this process called globalization, which assumes very much in consciousness and in representation as if it's something ethereal, something that's so far up there that, you know, somehow or other none of us can deal with it. It's operating on us, you know. Governments can't control it, nobody can control it. There's something called globalization that's going on. It has this ethereal quality to it. But that ethereal quality then connects to, as it were, the opposite end of the scale of things, which is the notion of the individual and the personal. And it sometimes seems like dialogue and discussion get segregated into this discussion of globalization, which is way up there, and then personal life, personal well-being, the person, as it were, at the other end down here, and somehow or other there's no connectivity between those two levels. One of the things I tried to do in the last book is to say, well, what is the connectivity between those two discourses of globalization and, for example, the body or the person, the individual? What is the connection between the two? And, of course, if you think of the labor process, immediately you see what the connection is, that the body of the worker in a Nike plant in Indonesia is being used in a certain kind of way for certain kinds of purposes which connect to the first. So there are all sorts of connections that exist. But there is also an interesting progressive connection, and I want to play on the duality here. A progressive connection. There's been a tremendous resurgence in the last few years of interest in questions of, say, human rights, which is about the rights of individuals and the body in relationship to these global processes. And at that point, you kind of start to see the connectivity, and then you start to see it at other levels, like some of the international conferences on population and women talk about, you know, okay, what's the reproductive rights of women, you know, women, and what has that got to do, as it were, with the global processes of population transformation? So there's, as it were, there are points of dialogue between those two levels, and I want to come back to that a little later, because the next point I want to make is that actually, if you start to unpack what globalization is about, it doesn't exist as some ethereal aspect up there. It actually is occurring at all kinds of different levels, at all kinds of different scales. And I think we have to start to look at the different scales of which the globalization process is operating in order to better get a better grasp on how to politically intervene in relationship to it. Because one of the things that I've been very antagonistic to over the last few years is this sense of helplessness, that you can't intervene, you can't do anything. The best you can do is do something in your own backyard, take care of your own property and enhance its value or something like that, and you can't do anything much else, you know. And that came over in this famous Margaret Thatcher phrase, which I'm thoroughly at war with, which is the notion that there is no alternative. And to say, well, maybe we should be thinking alternatives, and then the issue arises, where can we think alternatives, how can we think alternatives? And it's very hard to think alternatives if you just think about globalization as some ethereal set of processes that nobody's in control of. But you can start to think alternatives when you start to unpack it. Globalization has implications at the very personal level. And I've mentioned this issue about human rights. And the resurgence in recent years, for example, with this notion of crimes against humanity. General Pinochet being arrested in London at the behest of a Spanish judge for crimes committed in Chile. Well, this is one aspect of globalization, and it's a very interesting aspect. It starts to say there are ways to hold individuals and entities accountable in some way for events in other parts of the world. And this is, as it were, you know, this is one of the places where there are some constructive possibilities that come out of the globalization argument. But globalization also has effects at other levels, at, for example, the community level. David has talked a little bit about this. I think it's very important to recognize that what's happening in, say, San Diego, or what's happening in Baltimore, is not just something which is just our own backyard politics. It is connected in very important ways to what this globalization process is about. And by acting at that level, you can actually engage in transformative work which has possibilities when taken towards other levels to do something, you know, quite different about the political situation. Many people have given up on the nation state. They say the nation state is powerless anymore. Well, you know, having crossed that border down there twice in the last couple of days, the idea the nation state is powerless? Come off it. I mean, this is crazy. And so at that level, there is also something which is crucial. Nation states are not powerless. Nation states are terribly important containers of power with the possibility of engaging with this process in quite different ways. And if you start to look at the ways in which different nation states have responded to globalization, have affected globalization, then you could kind of say national state policy is actually a very important terrain of intervention. There are regional configurations which are below the nation state, in some instances above the nation state. Regional configurations which are rather important to consider. And actually the formation of regional consciousness in some cases, you see it happening in many areas of Europe, at the same time as you're getting the European Union, a sort of large-scale region, you're also getting lots of regional consciousness movements which are emerging, I mean, not only in the traditional centers like the Basque country, but also in northern Italy and places like that. So you're getting, as it were, again, a different reconfiguration. Again, those things are not unconnected with this very general process that we call globalization. And then there are the multinational or transnational institutions, like the European Union, like NAFTA, which are also important in the way in which this process is being worked out. And then there are the global institutions, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and all those things that have been the target of a lot of radical attention in the last few years through Seattle, Washington, Prague, Melbourne, and the like. So when you start to think about it, you see that there are all these layers of activities that occurring at different scales, and one of the questions we need to look at is what's the relationship between, say, what is happening here in San Diego at the community level, very local community level, at the metropolitan level, and what that relationship also is to, as it were, a kind of regional consciousness that might be emerging across the border. What is that all about, and how does that relate, as it were, to the processes of globalization? Because there have been many transformative things occurring in the last few years. Just to give you one example which struck me quite catastrophically yesterday when looking at that, you know, Operation Gatekeeper and the Wall. I mean, I kept on thinking back to the tremendous euphoria that attached to the attack on the Berlin Wall, when people took sledgehammers and smashed the whole thing down. And frankly, my response to that, the balloon event, was I wanted to take a sledgehammer to that damn wall. And then thinking, well, why is that wall somehow or other regarded legitimate? Why are we putting walls up in some parts of the world and tearing them down elsewhere? Why are people going behind gated communities, living in gated communities, putting walls all over the place? At the same time, we've got globalization going on. What's going on? What's the relationship between these two? And I want to argue the relationships are not contingent or accidental. There is a structural transformation going on in the ways in which life is being worked out geographically through globalization. Now, what kinds of responses can we have to these two processes of globalization, technological change? It seems to me there are some fundamental questions that might be asked. I work in a university, and I can assure you these questions are not generally asked inside of the university. I'm not sure they're being asked anywhere in any sort of coherent form. A month ago, I was in the Vatican, of all places. I'm not Catholic, I'm not particularly religious at all. But one of the things that was interesting about the discussion in the Vatican was precisely this issue of saying, what does it mean to be human right now? And can we develop a way of thinking which resonates with the marginalized, the oppressed, the excluded, the alienated? And if so, what kinds of things would we want to say? As a force which is in opposition to, from the Vatican's language, the crass materialism and the nihilism and the postmodernism of contemporary culture and all the rest of it. And I think, for me anyway, what was interesting was the seriousness of the question. What does it mean to be a human being right now with all of these capacities and powers in front of us? And how are we going to understand ourselves? And some of these issues are being discussed in things like issues about human rights in general, the interests of collective rights, the whole kinds of questions of cultural relativism, issues of those sorts. So there is a whole series of sites, if you want to call it that, of discussion, of thinking and of feeling, and I think feeling is probably more important than thinking, a feeling that there is something which is catastrophically wrong. There's something that is really out of whack. We seem to be headed in the wrong direction. We're on the wrong train. We need to get off it. We need to create another one. How can we do it? And if you ask yourself the question, where is there opposition to this whole system we're talking about occurring? The answer is it's all over the place. I find it in my own city in terms of living wage movements and discontent and alienation in many marginalized communities. I find it in many other places, you know, the peasant movements in India or movements in rural Brazil. I mean, you name it, there's sort of movements all over the place which are oppositional movements. All of them expressing the view that something's wrong. And something's got to be done. And it can sometimes take specific issues about, you know, the environment or cultural autonomy or personal liberties and freedoms and all those sorts of things. But there's something wrong. And then we have to start to talk about, well, why is this thing that's wrong so wrong? My answer is a very simple one. It's because we've given up before the powers of capital accumulation and money. Simple as that. We lie down in front of it all. Which is not to say everybody who wields that power is an evil, nasty kind of person, but to say basically, look, that's where the power lies, and we seem not to be able to mobilize ourselves against it. Look at the elections, look at what David was talking about. So how do we start to configure a conversation about alternatives? And that conversation has to address what for me is a really fundamental kind of issue about who are we, what do we want to become, what kind of world do we want to live in? And if capital can't give us that world, then we should find some way to get rid of capital and construct something completely different. And that's a revolutionary solution. Terrible place to say that right here, right? There are possibilities, it seems to me, that the social democratic possibility would be control it in some way. Turn it into a servant rather than a master. Control it. And to see if it can be used. And actually right now, of course, we're getting all of these institutions which are precisely about regulation and control. We have sort of the questions of financial instability. How could that be regulated and controlled? We have questions of the environment. How can that be regulated and controlled? We have sort of social and political questions. How can that be regulated and controlled? So actually right now there's a whole kind of almost coming back of a notion of there's going to be some global regulatory apparatus. And along with that sort of issue, which is a sort of seen as a technical sort of managerial kind of problem, comes another problem, which is what kinds of values are going to be incorporated in those institutions? Which is what the struggle in Seattle in many ways was about. What kinds of values should be incorporated in the WTO or in the IMF, if you can put any values in them whatsoever other than the purely monetary ones? So those are the issues that then come back, these sorts of moral issues. Where can these things be discussed? Will they be discussed within the formal structure of university education? I don't see it. I really don't see it. I try to discuss it, but frankly, you know, I get pretty much marginalized in my own institution, which is one of the reasons I'm leaving Hopkins, because it's all about selling itself to technological change and the state apparatus. It's all about that. It's all about gaining money. I don't earn enough research grants. I'm a non-valued person in my institution, and they make clear you're non-valued, and they treat you that way. You're a parasite because you're not giving yourself over to government and industry. Have a mission statement, the first draft of which said, we have to give ourselves over to serving government and industry. And when I got up and said, well, what about the public interest? What about the poor? People kind of said, maybe we should modify the statement, but they're not going to modify the practice. So it might not occur there. Will it occur through, I don't know, museums and so on? I don't know much about museums and so on. And it seems to me that organizations like Insight have a real possibility. And it's a possibility, not necessarily a realization, and we might want to discuss that, of exploring some of the contradictions that exist within this process, particularly between the levels, between the way in which the personal is political for many artists and that, and the way in which that relates to something called community, which maybe relates to the question of regional consciousness across border. Are there sort of certain contradictory elements there that can be actually played upon? And how can those contradictory elements be played upon? I think this is, for me, the sort of question which arises, is Insight a site where these kinds of issues can be discussed and brought to the fore? And how can they be brought to the fore? That is, as I say, the major issue from my standpoint. So there are then these two fundamental questions that I would want to look at. And in looking at them, I think it's not that we can look at them and say, well, you know, I have all the answers, or, you know, this is what we should do and this is how we should do it. But it is a moment where I think we need conversations. Conversations about alternatives, conversations about where we are, where we're going with all this stuff, how to understand it perhaps, and having understood it a bit better, put ourselves in a position to intervene in it in some sort of conscious political way through the formation of alliances, through the configuration of linking together activities at one scale with another scale. You know, there's a tendency for people who work with community action to say the only place that matters is community action. As people who work at the state say it's at the state that matters. People who work in the global institutions say the global institutions matter. They all matter. And if we can find ways to talk across those different scales of political action, I think we'll be in a much better position to confront some of the dynamics of technological change and globalization. Thank you very much.